Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a preview of the Earth Day rally at 4 p.m. Thursday, April 22nd at Congressmembers Paul Tonka's office in downtown Albany, calling on him to be a climate champion and oppose fossil fuels. Then for our peace segment, we talk with David Swanson of World Beyond War. Later on, Scott Kellogg, presenter at the upcoming Sustainable Futures Conference, speaks about urban ecosystem justice. We then talk with the director of the Damien Center in Albany and their work on AIDS. And we finish with the talk on the People's Campaign for Parole Justice about the racial disparities in parole release rates. But first, here are the headlines. The border between the United States and Canada closed since the pandemic lockdown began in March 2020 will remain closed to leisure travelers at least another month through May 21st. Just 2.5% of Canadians have been fully vaccinated.
The Times Union reports that the long dominant proposal to create a downtown canal in Albany along Broadway is picking up momentum. For much of its four centuries, Albany has had a downtown boat basin. The downtown waterway was filled in with concrete when the 787 was built in the 1960s.
Hannaford Supermarkets has achieved a long-standing goal of diverting all the food waste from its 187 stores out of landfills. Much of this food is donated to emergency food programs. Other food is provided for livestock consumption, primarily pigs. The rest goes to anaerobic digesters to produce methane gas for electricity. About 40% of all food in the United States ends up as waste.
The Times Union reports that Avril Park's Rudy Winkler is off to a strong start to bid for his second Olympics in Japan this summer. The hammer thrower set the world's best mark of 2021 in his first meet of this year.
As marijuana users celebrated the legalization of pot on the annual 420 observance, Montgomery County Economic Development officials met to advance a proposal to turn the old Beechnut facility in Canada Johari into a cannabis cultivation site.
In advance of his Earth Day climate summit, President Biden announced that the U.S. will set a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by 2030. And that's it for the headlines. And you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
And for our first segment this evening, Earth Day climate change groups will rally at 4 o'clock outside Congressman Paul Tonka's office in Albany to urge him to be a climate champion and remove false solutions from his Clean Futures bill. Mark talks with Francis Maggi of PAUSE, P-A-U-S-E, Francella of Extinction Rebellion.
This Thursday is Earth Day, and a number of Capital District climate groups, people have all been United for Safe Energy, XR, Save the Pine Bush, Upper Hudson Green Party, Food and Water Watch, are doing a rally and possible march out in front of Congressman Paul Tonka's office in Albany at Dove and Washington to ask him to be more of a climate champion to support
taking a climate emergency action and to halt fossil fuels. And we're joined today by two of the organizers, Frances McGuy, who is one of the conveners of PAUSE, and Rachel Frischella, who's with XR. Frances, can you tell why have you decided to help pull this event together?
Yes. Well, thanks for having me, first off. And we decided to get this thing together because it's so important that we make decisive climate action very soon in order to mitigate the impending climate crisis. And it's really been far too long that we've needed impactful and meaningful climate legislation. And Congress member Tonko is actually in a position of power to do so, being the chair of, I think it's the, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, I think it's something like the Climate and Environmental Subcommittee in the House. And he's in a very safely democratic district. And so he should be a progressive, we think. But his climate policy is just really weak and just plays a hand to keeping the fossil fuel industry going while kind of having this face that they're doing something about it. So it's ludicrous how he presents himself as a person who really cares about the climate and a climate champion, because it would be hard to be farther from the truth.
Right. I know a number of people complain about his so-called Clean Futures Act, which includes support for things like garbage incineration and carbon capture and continued use of fossil fuels, nuclear power. But, you know, Rachel, why is XR involved? And also understand, you know, part of the theme is the tides are rising.
Yes. So XR is a big civil disobedience chapter within the climate movement. That's kind of our main MO, is to create as much civil disobedience that we can. You know, lobbying is great and a very effective part of creating change, but mostly it's the people power. So that's why XR is getting involved, to really show Tonko the numbers of people who need him to be a better climate advocacy. Yeah. And our theme is the tides are rising, so are we. We know that ocean risings and water risings are going to happen. You know, all of the New York City will basically be underwater soon. So we're letting Tonko know that, like, time is of the essence and the water is going to come, and it's going to come for him. And he needs to help mitigate that by making sure that, you know, we can have 100% clean, renewable electricity by 2030 and zero emissions soon after, and trying to get that those greenhouse gas emissions to net zero as well.
I know one of the things the climate movement, you know, in general has been pushing the last couple of years is not only support to, you know, dedicate, you know, climate funding to help frontline communities, disadvantaged communities, environmental justice community, and a just transition. But they also, you know, highlight that, you know, the various issues are interconnected. And particularly right now, I think many people are very concerned about the issue of racial justice. You know, have the organizers talked about how to address that a bit?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's something that we need to be very aware of. And it's something that we're inviting a speaker to come from the recent Black Lives Matter and racial justice protests that have been happening in Albany to speak about what's going on there and how we can help, because it's a really important moment for that struggle. And honestly, I feel a little conflicted about having a rally of size at this moment because of that, and I don't want to overshadow it. But given how the climate emergency is progressing, I don't feel like we can waste time. So I think we're just going to give a platform to the organizers in that struggle to talk about what we can do to support them.
Now, of course, a lot of demonstrations have really been halted over the last year because of COVID. You know, any thoughts about how, as you know, more people get vaccinated and people get out a little bit more, you know, how can the climate movement, you know, sort of retake the streets?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's like a lot of different ways that we'll be able to do that. Hybrid actions have kind of been a big turning point for us. We did a lot of projections over the past year that have been great. Just making sure that everybody is masked and keeping kind of as socially distanced as we can. But, you know, the everything is connected within the climate crisis. You know, the pandemic has been linked to the climate crisis and everything. So it's very important to keep that in mind as well.
Now, you know, one of the issues some people have sort of, you know, criticized the more mainstream politicians. They seem to get the idea that we have to speed up the transition to renewable energy, but not have been quite as forceful in saying we need to halt all new, you know, fossil fuels now, and we have to, you know, stop promoting natural gas. What are some of the concerns about, you know, the fossil fuel future?
Well, I think if we look at the science, it just shows that going forward with new fossil fuel projects is absolutely the wrong direction for us to be going. And if we're going to be, net zero by 2045 and have clean electricity and be well on our way to net zero throughout our society, carbon net zero, that is, by 2030, we're really going to need to shift the way that we power everything in our lives, and it's not really going to work to just keep on going with fossil fuels. We have to stop that because we haven't really even come to the peak in terms of carbon that's being let off, carbon emissions, and it's just we need to very, very quickly cut down on our carbon emissions. And there's no way we can do that if we're continuing to expand our fossil fuel burning infrastructure.
Now, one of the big changes in the climate movement in the last few years has really been an emergence of voices of young people who have, you know, said, listen, this is the world that we're going to inherit. And we're very concerned there's not enough guarantee that we're going to have a decent, you know, future for ourselves and for our children. How are young people participating in the April 20th, 4 p.m. protest at Congressman Tonko's office in Albany with a minute to go?
We will have a bunch of young speakers, one of them being Almy Bardis. They'll be taking part of flyering and bringing signs and just having their voices there because, like you said, Mark, they are the future and like, this is what we're trying to mitigate for them because they're going to, you know, Tonko might not be around in 2050, but these young people will face the consequences of his actions if he does not speed up to a more renewable energy and stop fossil fuels.
Right. And so we've been talking with Frances McGuy of PAWS and Rachel from Frescala of XR. This is the 51st anniversary of Earth Day, Thursday, April 22nd, at 4 p.m., Congressman Paul Tonko's office at Dove and Washington Avenue. People are certainly welcome to come and participate. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio.
And so we will hope to provide some additional coverage of the rally taking place tomorrow. Also, President Biden's holding an Earth Day climate summit. He's going to announce that the U.S. is going to commit to a 50% cut in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. Many people think that's a strong move. Others like to see it stronger.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
But first, we're going to go to David Swanson of World Beyond War, who is going to speak at a Green Party Eco Action Forum on Sunday, April 25th at 4 p.m. about climate and the military. Here he discusses with me the military budget, Afghanistan, and Yemen.
For today's Peace Bucket, we're joined by David Swanson, longtime peace activist, executive director of World Beyond War. David is going to be part of a forum webinar on climate and the military that Eco Action is doing this Sunday at 4 p.m. But we wanted to get David on to talk about, World Beyond War. Of course, he's been here, previously. So we just passed what used to be tax day, April 15th. How are we doing military spending these days?
I don't know if you saw, Mark, the article I wrote on that day, sort of revising one I've written in previous years, but it just astounds me that people in the United States are just such fans of World War II. It seems to me to be the top subject of movies and TV shows and books and every medium there is, and yet there's such hatred for taxes. Because where the heck do people think taxes came from? They came from World War II, and they were supposed to end, like the troops in Germany and the troops in Japan and the military bases around the world and the military spending and the war footing. It was all supposed to end. The use of the Pentagon was supposed to end. They were trying to figure out what to do with that building after World War II ever ended, and it hasn't really ever ended. And ordinary people weren't taxed, until World War II. And now, of course, it's never ending. And so I agree with people on hating taxes in the United States because it was supposed to be for a war that never ended, because people pay at a higher rate than billionaires and corporations, many of which pay nothing, and because you get darn little back for them. There are places on this earth where you can pay your taxes and get healthcare and education and retirement and childcare and transportation and recreation. And, here you don't. So here, the majority goes into wars and preparations for more wars. That's the problem.
But doesn't it create jobs and put people to work?
It astounds me how many people believe that. And it's, sort of, let's look at the evidence. My neighbor works for a subcontractor and his neighbor works for a contractor and his cousin's in the Navy. And yes, these are real people with real jobs. But there's never been any dispute among the economists that you get more jobs for real people that pay better and have a better impact on the economy and create other jobs if you put the money into just about anything else, certainly education, green energy, infrastructure, or even don't tax it from working people in the first place. You get more jobs. So military spending eliminates jobs, as someone might figure out just by thinking about how destructive, not to mention corrupt, military spending is. But this is the fact. It is a job eliminator.
Now, speaking of wars that never end, President Biden recently announced that American troops will pull out on, the 20th anniversary of September 11 from Afghanistan, the longest war in American history. For some reason, the media sort of forgot to mention that, in fact, the agreement that President Trump had negotiated with the Taliban in Afghanistan actually talked about, withdrawing the troops from May. So this actually was a postponement of the withdrawing of the troops. But does that actually mean that we're finally going to see an end to the war in Afghanistan?
Well, there are a number of problems with this sort of propaganda coming out of the White House, which is not that different from previous administrations. First of all, it is not remotely the longest war in U.S. history, a conclusion that everyone across the entire political spectrum is happy with, but is based on the notion that Native Americans are not real human beings and the wars against them, many of which were far longer than this one, are not real wars. Second of all, the withdrawal of troops in a war that is primarily an air war, that involves primarily sending bombs and missiles into people's houses, is not the ending of participation in a war. It's just the ending of ground participation in a war. And when you're openly trumpeting how you're going to leave in the secret agencies and the special forces and the mercenaries and so forth, it's not even that. And so, you know, obviously any de-escalation of a war is progress. Any removal of troops is progress. If the United States removes a few thousand troops and over 30 other countries remove between, you know, 6 troops and 1,000 troops that they each have in there, that goes a long way. For one thing, it delegitimizes the war in the minds of people who think a crime is more legitimate the more criminals are involved in the gang. But it doesn't actually end the war. You know, and of course, if the United States does actually get out of Afghanistan and Afghanistan's airspace, well, then it remains to be seen what the people of Afghan are able to do nonviolently or violently. But they aren't going to have a chance until the United States and its sidekicks get out.
Well, speaking of air wars, we had John Amidon of Veterans for Peace and other groups. He goes out to Hancock Air Force Base. Ally's going to be out there for Earth Day. That's where they run a lot of the drones. So are we bringing the drones home from Afghanistan and Pakistan, or just some of the troops?
Well, presumably there will not be drones taking off and landing in Afghanistan, but there will be drones flying over Afghanistan and shooting missiles into unknown victims in Afghanistan. They'll just be taking off from ships in the Persian Gulf and from Jordan and Qatar and Djibouti and other places where the United States has bases and ships and missiles and planes. So this is the problem. As John knows, a bunch of anti-drone activists in the United States have just launched a campaign to try to create a treaty globally to ban weaponized drones. Their website is bankillerdrones.org, on the model of the new treaty prohibiting nuclear weapons, on the model of the treaty banning landmines, etc. And I think this is long since needed and badly needs to be supported.
When we had Mabel Leon a couple of weeks ago from Schenectady, she was a little upset that she didn't get to talk about Yemen in her 10 minutes. So what's going on with Yemen? Has, you know, Biden war, you know, basically told Saudi Arabia to stop this genocide, this war in Yemen, or is that still going on?
The latter, clearly. What Congress did when it could count on a Trump veto, both houses twice, passed with bipartisan strong majorities, for the first time ever, using the War Powers Resolution of 1973, they ended the war on Yemen, counting on Trump to veto it, so no risk of actually doing anything, God forbid. Now that Biden is president from the Democratic Party, Congress won't lift a finger to end any of these wars or make any commitment to reducing military spending. Not a single Congress member that I've found is willing to make any commitment to voting no on bills that maintain or increase military spending. And so you have this announcement from Biden to sort of hold off Congress doing anything, saying that he's ending the war on Yemen. Except for, you know, he's ending offensive operations. So as long as you call anything defensive, it's cool. And he's ending relevant weapon sales. So as long as, you know, this $23 billion weapon sale to United Arab Emirates is irrelevant, it's cool. So no, there's been no pressure put on Saudi Arabia to end the blockade that is threatening literally millions of deaths. There are so many, many people malnourished and on the edge of starvation in Yemen, not to mention the disease and the violence. It has long been the worst catastrophe happening on Earth. And no, unless you cut off the weapons and the support and the maintenance and the training and the assistance for the use of the weapons, you know, there's no and as long as Biden is pretending that the blockade isn't even there, you know, no, this disaster is continuing, and it shows you what little spine and integrity there is to be found in the United States Congress.
So we've been talking with David Swanson. World Beyond War, going to be speaking at the Eco Action, the Green Party U.S. Webinar, Sunday, 4 p.m., Climate and Military. David, if people want more information about what you're doing, how best can they get that?
Well, I'm at davidswanson.org. You can check out worldbeyondwar.org or rootsaction.org for some places I work. Thanks, Mark.
Well, thank you, David. This has been Mark Dunlay for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. And that was David Swanson. We do a piece segment, a second segment of each Wednesday. If you want to check out the Eco Action Forum on Military and Climate, you can go to www.facebook.com/GP Eco Action, GP for Green Party.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
You're still Andrea. That's good to hear. And I'm Mark Dunlay. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And to learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. And for our next segment, Scott Kellogg, Educational Director of the Radix Ecological Sustainability Center, will be presenting Urban Ecosystems Justice at the Sustainable Futures Conference taking place April 27th through the 30th. He spoke with HMM's Sina Basila-Hickey.
My name is Scott Kellogg. I'm the Educational Director at the Radix, R-A-D-I-X, Ecological Sustainability Center. We're a nonprofit organization based in the south end of Albany, building a demonstration site of sustainable tools and technologies that are designed to teach urban residents, specifically urban youth, how to have greater local access and control over essential resources such as food, water, waste management, energy production, with an emphasis on building systems that are simple and affordable, all of the ultimate goal of teaching ecological literacy to area youth and performing environmental justice advocacy in the South End neighborhood as a whole.
How does your work relate to the field of sustainability?
So it's really central to it all. And you know, sustainability is a fairly nebulous term that gets tossed around a lot. Most people have vague at best notions of what it actually is. And it's got quite a bit of transformative potential, I believe, when you look at its original definition and what it is intended to be. I think far too often it is co-opted as to be more or less a marketing term, a buzzword. But, you know, when you look at its original definition, it's about being mindful of the social, economic, and environmental aspects of life. I mean, there's plenty that we could critique there, at least in terms of equating those three with one another. I think there are certain things that it's not appropriate to value, for instance, the health of the economy as much as you do the health of the global ecosystem or human health. However, really, you know, what's going on in the past couple decades discursively is that the so-called social pillar of sustainability has been marginalized, has been pushed to the side, where there is greater emphasis on the economic and environmental dimensions of sustainability and less on aspects of justice and fairness and equity and access and race and class. And I think what we have to do is really be very deliberate and explicit about recentering that so-called social pillar of sustainability, which is really a key component of the work that we do, is asking how questions of equity and access and fairness and justice pertain to things such as food and water and waste management and energy production and soils and biodiversity and atmospheres.
Great. And could you talk more about that? How are you addressing that in your programming?
Really, we base a lot of our pedagogy around this concept of urban ecosystem justice, which is similar to what I've really just sort of is describing, but thinking about how equity and justice apply to the so-called biophysical spheres of the urban ecosystem, the soil, the waters, the airs, the non-human life, the waste cycles, in a way, especially with our programs with youth, which underscore the relevance of it, the importance of it, the way a lot of environmental education is done conventionally in this country is that it devalues urban ecosystems. It teaches that the quote environment, or that quote nature, pure nature, nature worth studying, is something out there beyond the limits of the city, and therefore it doesn't have any interest or relevance to urban populations, and particularly urban youth, causing them to internalize a lot of negative attitudes about nature and the environment. So by one, showing that urban ecosystems do have interest and value can challenge ecological alienation that many people suffer from, but at the same time, working to recenter the social pillar of sustainability and taking a cue from the environmental justice movement, which extends definitions of the environment to include human, social, and economic processes, cultural, that when we see those overlap in the city, it has the effect of centering and making explicit social dimensions of sustainability.
And it sounds like part of your work is to heal this possibly traumatic relationship between cities and the earth and nature.
Sure, absolutely. That cities are conceived very much as being these sort of human-only places. That is really the philosophical basis of modernity, which is the dualism of nature and society. And that's a false dichotomy. That's a false dualism. And what we're trying to do is break that down and show how even in cities are the co-evolutionary products of both human and non-human processes. They're not monocultures for Homo sapiens. There's a lot of other species that live here that we co-create with and need to have reciprocal relationships with.
Education is a big part of the concept of the RADx Ecological Sustainability Center. But so where does a lot of the change really come in? Is it the individual level, educating individuals? How much of sustainability needs to come from the city or from the state? What have you seen as the effective way of really creating some regeneration in cities?
So you mentioned regeneration. That's a really important part of it, right? Sustainability is not enough. Sustainability is just sort of maintaining the status quo. A regenerative paradigm pushes beyond that to where we are actually trying to repair ecological damage and to promote social justice and equity. So that's critically important. And I think it needs to happen on every level, from the formal to the informal to the non-formal. So within public schools, that's great if it can happen there, but also outside of the school, in just day-to-day interactions with people in the public and with after-school programs like the one that we run as well, which I would probably fall more into the informal and non-formal sector. But a lot of it is just casual and incidental, just people passing by and stopping in to check things out and learning what they can.
Would you agree that a lot of regenerative lessons can be learned from Indigenous communities? And is there a space for bringing in Indigenous voices in this process of green recovery?
Absolutely. We need to recognize the historical erasure and genocide of Indigenous populations that took place in this country upon the myth of the founding of the United States is based upon, and something that doesn't get discussed nearly so frequently. But those Indigenous societies, in the case of the Mohican and the Mohawk peoples, the original inhabitants of what is now Albany and the Capital District, were the only people who've ever had a successful track record of living genuinely sustainably in this region for thousands of years. And in just a handful of generations, we've all but decimated it. So there's clearly a huge amount that we could stand to learn from those people who are still surviving to this day. And of course, the form of the Munsee-Stockbridge people.
What work would you like to see come out of the Sustainable Futures Conference?
I think it's a great opportunity to organize, to bring people together, different leaders in the field. I would love to see the ideas in it make the leap into the public sphere, right? For the next phase of the conference to involve the general public and the people whose lives are going to be impacted by this decision, who possess a great expert knowledge.
That was Scott Kellogg of Radix Ecological Sustainability Center with our multifaceted senior Basila Hickey. The Sustainable Futures Conference is happening April 27th to 30th. To learn more, visit www.sustainablefuturesconference.com. And Erica Dulcina Diggs spoke with Perry Jujulis, the executive director of Albany Damien Center. The Damien Center focuses on living with HIV and provides tools to help cope with AIDS.
Good morning. This is HM correspondent Erica Dulcina Diggs, and I'm speaking with Perry Jujulis of the Damien Center. He is the executive director. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you? Sorry for jumping on the good morning too quick.
No problem. I love the energy. It's Monday, fun day, right? All right. So let's just get started. Tell me, who started this foundation?
Sure. So the Albany Damien Center was started back in 1988. It was actually an initiative of the Episcopal Church. They were looking for a way to respond to the AIDS crisis back in 1988. And so they got together with some other state officials and they incorporated in 1991. So the Albany Damien Center is not a religious organization, but it certainly had a lot of religious friends to get it started. And really was the first drop-in center of its kind in the nation that specifically was for persons who were struggling and dying of HIV and AIDS to come together to offer non-medical social support. A living room, it was two rooms in a church, and that was the beginning. In 1988, there really were no drugs that were working, and there was a tremendous amount of stigma and discrimination. And so even the location of the Albany Damien Center was almost a secret. When you came up to the front door, someone would come down, they'd ask you some questions, and if you had the right answers, they would let you in. If you didn't, you weren't let in because the discrimination, stigma, and fear was just so high back then that they really wanted to keep it safe. So when you did walk upstairs, though, there was two rooms that were full of so much love, laughter, yes, some tears, but really a way for people to connect and try and share in what it was like to be dying of this disease.
Wow. Okay, so tell us, what programs do you offer at the Damien Center?
Sure. So what happened over time was medications came out. And so all of us who were supposed to die actually started to live. In fact, I was diagnosed with AIDS back in 1995, and I was told I had 3 months to live. So I went to the Damien Center trying to figure out, you know, what am I supposed to do? And I had no reason to doubt anybody that I was going to die in 3 months. I was watching everyone die around me. But that was when just about when the new drugs were starting to come out. And so all of a sudden, you know, we were living. We weren't dying as fast. Now, we weren't living very well. The side effects from the medications were positively awful. But the tone of the Damien Center changed from helping people with the dying process to helping people with the living process. So how do we live now with this disease, knowing that there's, you know, a ton of discrimination, a lot of stigma still out there, and a lot of us could not work, you know, so how do you live, you know, with that? So a lot of the Damien Center programs were based on helping people to live. So currently we have we still have our drop-in living room center, which is open for people to come in to get support from one another. We also have a meal program, which serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and also provides pantry bags, because we recognize that nutrition is just such a huge part of staying healthy with HIV, and too many people don't have access to real healthy, nutritious meals, fruits and vegetables, and also recipes of how to make certain foods. We also have a PAWS program. Our PAWS program was designed to help people keep their pets when they were ill or when they were going into the hospital. So our PAWS program provides supplemental vet care, food, but also in-home care when a person is ill, because we were watching too many people who were having to give up their beloved pets, often when they needed each other the most. We also have a housing program. So we have 20 units on site. We also have about 20 units that are off site. So we provide housing for persons who were formerly homeless living with AIDS, recognizing again that housing is healthcare. You need to have a home in order to access medications or any type of support. We have an employment pathways program, which is helping people to get back to work, because now we have some really great medications which are helping people. And so once on the medications and people are able to get their viral load to undetectable, a lot of people are going back to work. So our program helps people who may have been out of work for the past 5, 10, 20, sometimes 30 years to be able to get back to work, which is just a really incredible process to watch. At the end of the day, the Damien Center is about family. We become a family for everyone. And so when persons are still suffering with trauma, with severe poverty, with mental health issues, with substance use disorder, racism, they will come to us to help them to figure out how to move on with HIV on top of all of those issues. And it's very hard for someone who's experiencing any of those issues to be able to get access to the medications and the treatment that they really deserve. And so we work to help break down the barriers for each person to make sure they know they're loved and that they deserve to have the care that they need, and to make sure that they always have someone that they can rely on.
That's beautiful. Now, I understand that you originally came to the Damien Center because of your diagnosis. Now, how did you initially get involved? So, because at first you went for help. So, you know, tell us, how did you say, let me do wonderful work, you know, and help others?
It was quite accidental. You know, I was asked, but yeah, I started going to the Damien Center because I really needed help. I was very sick and also very scared, like everyone else was. And I just found this really beautiful center that, you know, one of the real cores was no judgment. You know, no judgment with whatever you were doing, whatever you did. And I just loved that. It was really put everybody on an equal playing field, you know, and if you would, you know, as far as understanding and really loving each other. So I really fell in love with the place. And so someone asked me to join the board, the board of directors, which I thought, okay, well, I never served on a board before. What could this be like? Well, the first board meeting, everybody had to chip in $50 to pay the phone bill because the phone was about to get turned off. And I remember sitting there going, I'm so getting off this board. This is not what I bargained for. I don't have any money, you know. So, you know, it was, you know, it was recognizing though that times were tough, you know, and money was tough. And so, you know, I continued on the board, you know, and one of the things that we were looking at was finding new space. So we were at Grace and Holy Innocence, which was on the corner of Clinton and Robin. And really the space was, the neighborhood was getting more dangerous. People were a little more nervous to come. And also we just needed bigger space. So they asked me to find space. I had a real estate background. And so I was able to find space, wrote a grant, and that's when we moved to 12 South Lake Avenue, right down the street. And at the time, as a part of the grant, I had to agree to stay on with the project for a year. That was 22 years ago. And so I became executive director. I was one of two staff. And we moved into 12 South Lake, where we were for 15 years before our building burned down, and really had some magical years there of watching people live with the disease, but also being there for people who were dying of the disease. And I do believe that, you know, as a person who is living with AIDS, also running the agency, I did bring a perspective of what it was like to be scared and to be sick. And so when people came in and I would say, I get what you're going through, they heard it. They saw me go through my illnesses. We sort of shared a lot of over that time. I am so thankful and grateful that I'm still here today, all these years later. I'm 55 years old. I was 29 when I was diagnosed, and I credit it to some luck. You know, not everybody was as lucky, but also having support, having access to the medications that really kept me alive through this time. And I'm very proud to say I have an undetectable viral load, which means my virus is so low that science right now can't pick it up. I still have it, but it's so low that it's not causing me any health concerns. Also, science is saying now that because I have an undetectable viral load, I cannot pass the virus to anybody else. And that's new science that came out in the past couple of years. It's called undetectable equals untransmittable. And just incredible. We can have somebody get their virus down to an extremely low level. They can't pass it on. So we have people having children now. We have people who are not fearing going out and telling people their HIV status as much because that weight is taken off of you. I'm not infectious anymore. I'm not, you know, able to pass it on. Again, not the case for everybody. And that's where we come in. That's where the Damien Center comes in. We work to try and get people to the undetectable market.
That's beautiful.
So please check us out, you know, either on our website or on our Facebook page and find out what's going on at the Damien Center and how you can get involved.
Okay, folks. Well, you just heard from Perry Gengelis, the executive director of the Damien Center. And they are out here changing lives. Be sure to go check them out, albanydamiencenter.org. Thank you so much, Mr. Gengelis.
Thank you so much, Erica, for having me. This was a lot of fun.
It was. We'll be back.
And that was Erica Diggs talking to the executive director of the Albany Damien Center.
And survivors of crime and violence and survivor advocates are working together in support of parole reform. Eileen Javier talks with Chelsea Miller of the People's Campaign for Parole Justice. They're talking here about the racial disparities in parole release rates.
Crime survivors and advocacy groups are working together to support the parole justice legislative package. And our guest today is Chelsea Miller, the communications director for the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Hi, Chelsea. How are you?
Hi. Thank you for having me.
On March 9th, 2021, the Fair and Timely Parole Bill got voted to pass by the New York Assembly Corrections Committee. Can you please speak what is the Fair and Timely Parole Bill?
Yeah. And first, it's really important to know what the current standard is. So currently, the parole board often denies people parole based on the one thing they can never change, which is their original crime of conviction. It essentially resentences people to years or decades of more prison time. The Fair and Timely Parole Bill, you know, if passed and if signed into law, will require the parole board to grant parole release to incarcerated people who are eligible for release on parole, unless that individual presents a current and reasonable risk to community safety, which cannot be mitigated by parole supervision. The legislation grants the parole board discretion to review not only the original crime of conviction, but also any steps an individual has taken to demonstrate personal accountability and transformation during their sentence.
Okay. You have been a victim of sexual assault yourself. What can you tell people who believe that we are safer locking up people for life?
Sure. The People's Campaign for Parole Justice believes that endless punishment actually poses a systemic barrier to healing and accountability. It ignores the diversity of needs of survivors of violence and trauma. It compounds the trauma suffered by incarcerated survivors of sexual violence and domestic violence, and it takes necessary resources away from community safety. So instead, we want healing and care for all survivors. We want opportunities for meaningful accountability for people who have committed violence and harm, and investments in community-led initiatives to prevent and respond to violence. We believe that parole reform, which expands access to release, will move us towards these goals. I think it's important to mention that even if fair and timely parole is passed and signed into law, crime victims and other community members who have concerns about a specific individual's release do have avenues to make sure their voice is heard. Crime victims can register with the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, or DOCS. They have an Office of Victim Assistance, so that crime victims can receive written notifications about the parole process if the individual who harmed them is eligible for parole. they can submit a victim impact statement to the parole board for consideration. Other community members may send letters of support or opposition regarding release to the supervising offender rehabilitation coordinator at the prison in which that individual is incarcerated. As someone who is simultaneously a survivor of sexual violence and also an advocate for survivors, I need to emphasize that no one can speak for all survivors. Survivors' needs and beliefs about criminal justice are just as varied and diverse as we are. However, I can say that the People's Campaign for Parole Justice has actively included survivors and survivor advocates at every level of this campaign. I'd be happy to speak further on this, but we have also found that many survivors indicate that they tend to favor shorter prison sentences and more spending on prevention and rehabilitation. We want accountability and we want healing. And we believe that this is one step that can expand access to hope, healing, and accountability.
What is in the parole justice legislative package?
So the overall package consists of two bills, the Fair and Timely Parole Bill, which we've discussed. It also includes elder parole, which would allow incarcerated people who are age 55 or older, who have already served at least 15 years of their sentence, to appear before the parole board for a hearing to be considered for release. We are also calling on Governor Cuomo to fully staff the parole board with 19 commissioners who come from communities that have been directly affected by mass incarceration and have professional and clinical backgrounds, including social work, nursing, reentry, and other fields that allow them to evaluate incarcerated people for who they are today. The board currently has 3 vacancies. We've also noticed that the parole board tends to be vulnerable to political pressure and pressure from other advocacy organizations. We hope that fully staffing and depoliticizing the parole board will bring greater equality for incarcerated people.
Can you speak to the chance that someone eligible for parole has in actually being granted parole under the current system?
Under the current system, very few people are actually released on parole. If someone is eligible for release on parole, it means they've served the minimum period of incarceration to which they've been sentenced. In 2015, only 177 incarcerated people were released upon their first appearance before the parole board, and only 20 after subsequent appearances. So that's only 200 people in 2015. A recent investigation found that the New York State Parole Board was also significantly less likely to release Black people relative to their white counterparts. So not only is it generally unlikely that someone is released on parole under the current system, it's also rigged against Black people. If fair and timely parole is passed and signed into law, as I said earlier, the parole board will be required to grant parole to incarcerated people who are eligible for release, unless that individual presents a current and reasonable risk to community safety, which cannot be mitigated by parole supervision.
We're talking today with Chelsea Miller, the communications director of the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault. People who have experienced child sexual abuse, sexual assault, adverse childhood experiences, trauma, all those can lead to incarceration.
Yeah, and that's a really important point. We must always remember that survivors of crime and people impacted by mass incarceration are not two distinct groups, right? There are many survivors who have loved ones in prison, many survivors who have been criminalized for acts they've committed in the process of surviving abuse or violence, and many survivors who are incarcerated now, trying to heal from violence and abuse within the environment of our prisons. And to your point, many people who enter our prisons and jails have experienced violence and abuse prior to their incarceration. Surveys show that nearly 60% of people incarcerated in women's prisons, and as many as 94% of some women's prison populations, are survivors of violence, including rape, intimate partner violence, and child abuse. There are fewer studies asking about the trauma histories of people incarcerated in men's prisons, but we know that those histories are common there as well. We also want to emphasize that violence and abuse are also prevalent behind bars. In a survey conducted in 2020 by the Correctional Association of New York at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, 74% of respondents indicated that they had witnessed some form of violence or abuse by staff, including physical, sexual, and verbal abuse, while 53% of respondents reported experiencing these acts of violence by staff themselves. Some of what we're trying to do is to recenter the conversation and make sure that survivors who are also impacted by incarceration, whether they are incarcerated or criminalized themselves or their loved ones are, they must also be at the center of any conversations about criminal justice reform.
What can we do to help this go through to our Governor Cuomo to sign it?
Sure. Everyone can call your assembly members, your senators, call the governor's office, and let them know that you support parole justice. If you'd like to get involved with the People's Campaign for Parole Justice, you can find us on Facebook, find us on Twitter. We are tweeting at #ParoleJusticeNYS and just start flooding the phone lines and flood social media with your support. RAP Campaign's website, rappcampaign.com. As part of National Crime Victims' Rights Week, NISCASA is collaborating with the People's Campaign for Parole Justice and the Crime Victims Treatment Center in New York City to host a Parole Justice and Survivor Justice Advocacy Day, where we will host a press conference, we will have community gatherings and legislative meetings in support of the Elder Parole and Fair and Timely Parole Bills, where we'll focus on expanding pathways to hope, healing, and accountability. This will be Thursday, April 22nd. We'll begin at 10 a.m. And you can register at the link in our website. Visit www.niscasa.org/calendar, and you'll find it there.
And is there anything else that you would like to say to our listeners?
I would like to share with listeners just that it's the right thing to do. Our system is currently rigged against us, and we hope that parole justice and these meaningful reforms regarding parole will help us redirect funds to community safety. It will help us reduce the number of people who are incarcerated in New York's prisons. And we hope to reunite families across New York.
Thank you, Chelsea, for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciate you for sharing this story.
And that was Eileen Javier with Chelsea Miller of the People's Campaign for Parole Justice. You can find out more at RAP, RAPPcampaign.com. As part of National Crimes Victim Week, NYS, CASA, in partnership with the People's Campaign for Parole Justice, will host a Parole Justice and Survivor Justice Advocacy Day on Thursday, April 22nd. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley. We did have Andrea Cunliffe with us earlier. Our engineer is Senior Basila Hickey. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories at mediasanctuary.org through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, thanks for tuning in. Thank you.